Welcome to Chatham. My name's Donald Fines. I'm the staff historian here at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. By now, you've probably had an opportunity to look around the house. Now, I'd like to take you on a tour of Chatham's grounds, showing you some things that you might not otherwise see. Let's start out in the fields, where most of Chatham's residents would have spent their days. To get there, leave the house by the door you entered and follow the flagstone path through the center of the garden. At the end of the path is a brick walkway. Cross the walkway and stand in the grassy plot between the walkway and the gravel exit road. Land. To settlers living in colonial Virginia, it meant everything. Wealth, social status, prestige, power. Land-hungry immigrants of means gobbled up large tracts of land cheaply in those early days. Some they farmed, others they divided into parcels and sold to those who came later. William Fitzhugh, the immigrant, was one such colonist. The great-grandfather of Chatham's builder arrived in Virginia in the latter half of the 1600s and immediately set about acquiring land. In his lifetime, he amassed more than 50,000 acres, including 700 acres of what would later become Chatham. His descendants later bought another 588 acres here, increasing the property to nearly 1,300 acres. The family farmed these fields for four generations. Initially, it planted tobacco, but tobacco depleted the soil. By the time of the Revolution, Fitzhugh's descendants had switched mostly to grains such as wheat or corn. They used some of the grain to feed their livestock. The rest they used for their own consumption or sold at market. By then, Chatham was no longer simply a tract of land, but a plantation with a large house and dozens of smaller structures. We'll see one of those buildings at our next stop. Turn around and walk back toward the house. To the right of the house, you'll see a small brick building, once used as a laundry. Continue your tour in front of that building. Plantations in colonial Virginia were self-sustaining enterprises. There were few towns in those days, and purchasing items from England was expensive and took a great deal of time. By and large, if you needed something, you had to produce it yourself. Chatham was a case in point. In addition to the main house, there were many supporting structures, including barns, stables, storehouses, coach houses, smoke houses, a dairy, spring house, ice house, blacksmith shop, and grist mill. The owners also operated a fishery, a quarry, and a ferry. In front of you is the laundry, one of just two original dependencies to survive the centuries. The other is the brick kitchen at the other end of the main house. The other original buildings have long since disappeared. Running the plantation required a large workforce. In antebellum Virginia, that meant slaves. Slavery had been introduced into Virginia in the middle of the 17th century, and by the Civil War, slaves comprised more than 30% of Virginia's population. Here, in Stafford County, that number was even greater, about 40%. Chatham, being a large plantation, had a large number of slaves. Depending on the owner and the time of year, you might have seen anywhere from 40 to 100 slaves here. Some of the household servants may have lived near the main house, in buildings like this, but most probably lived in log cabins located out in the fields, well away from the main house. We don't know where those cabins were, and perhaps never will. The slaves did the labor at Chatham. Those with specialized skills might be assigned to cook in the kitchen, work at the blacksmith shop, or operate the mill. Most, however, toiled in the fields, planting the seeds, tilling the soil, and harvesting the crops, their only remuneration being one suit of work clothes a year, some food for their table, and a week off at Christmas. It was a hard life, and some slaves tried to flee. Others simply refused to work. That's what happened in January 1805 after the Christmas break. When an overseer here attempted to make the slaves go back to work, they lashed him with his own whip. A second white man, who came to the assistance of the overseer, was killed. News of the incident spread alarm throughout the white community. An armed force came out from Fredericksburg to put down the revolt. By the time it was over, two slaves were dead, two more were sold to owners outside the state, and a fifth man was tried for insurrection by the courts and sentenced to death. Such episodes underscored the evils of slavery, and in the North, people clamored for its abolition. But the South had invested too much money in its slaves to give them up willingly. In the end, it took a war to decide the issue, a war in which Chatham would play a key role. To reach the next stop, walk through the small gate to the left of the laundry A slate walkway begins there. Follow the walkway around to the front of the house. When you reach the front door, turn your player back on. Compared to their slaves, Chatham's owners live lives of ease and refinement. William Fitzhugh, the great-grandson of the man who first purchased the land, built Chatham between the years 1768 and 1771. Fitzhugh was one of Virginia's wealthiest and most powerful citizens. Prior to the American Revolution, he had served as a member of the House of Burgesses, where he gained the acquaintance of men like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, both of whom would later visit him here at Chatham. During the Revolution, Fitzhugh served the Patriot cause as a state senator and as a delegate to the Continental Congress. Fitzhugh built Chatham to impress people. From its commanding position here on Stafford Heights, the house looks proudly down on the town of Fredericksburg. To a person looking up at the building, the 185-foot-long structure seems huge. One would hardly guess that it had just 9 rooms, albeit large ones. The outside of the building is made entirely of brick, while inside it features expensive wood paneling. The house is unusual in that it's only 1 room wide. That's a great advantage in the days before electricity, for it made the rooms brighter and allowed breezes to circulate freely through the interior on hot summer days. Fitzhugh sold Chatham in 1806 to a former Revolutionary War officer named Churchill Jones. It was Jones who added a porch to the house. The porch is visible in photographs taken during the Civil War. Although it was removed early in the 20th century, you can still see its white outline around the center door. During the Civil War, Chatham was known as the Lacey House, after its owner James Horace Lacey, who had married Jones's niece. Lacey owned roughly 100 slaves and was a die-hard secessionist. When the Civil War began, he left Chatham to fight in the Confederate Army. While he was gone, 30,000 Union soldiers, led by General Irvin McDowell, occupied Fredericksburg. For several weeks, McDowell made Chatham his headquarters. While here, he received a visit from President Abraham Lincoln. Chatham thus has the distinction of being the only building to be visited by America's two greatest presidents, Washington and Lincoln. Union troops left Fredericksburg in September 1862, but not for long. 10 weeks later they returned, this time in far greater numbers, and under a new commander, General Ambrose C. Burnside. Follow the flagstone walk toward the river. On the second terrace, you'll find a reconstructed section of a pontoon bridge bordered by 2 signs. Stand next to the signs and turn your player back on. Below you lies the Rappahannock River, and beyond that, the city of Fredericksburg. When General Ambrose Burnside arrived here in November of 1862 with the Army of the Potomac, his goal was to capture Richmond and end the war. To reach Richmond, however, he had to cross the Rappahannock River, and to do that, he needed bridges. Unfortunately, the Confederates had destroyed the existing spans, forcing Burnside to rely on temporary bridges known as pontoons. In front of you is a replica of one small section of Pontoon Bridge. The problem was getting the pontoons to Fredericksburg. The Army had left the bridges back at the Potomac River when it crossed into Virginia 1 month earlier. To get them to Fredericksburg, engineers would have to float the pontoon boats down the C&O Canal to Washington, D.C., then place them on special wagons and haul them south over unpaved roads the 60-mile distance to Fredericksburg. Bad weather and other complications hindered the journey, and by the time the pontoons reached Fredericksburg, the Confederate Army was firmly ensconced on the other side of the river, blocking Burnside's path. The hapless Union general spent 3 weeks looking for a better place to cross, but all his other options seemed just as bad. In the end, he decided to make the crossing at Fredericksburg. Before dawn, on December 11th, teams of Union engineers manhandled the pontoon boats down a ravine 200 yards to your right as you face the river, and began quietly assembling them at the water's edge. In all, the Union Army built 6 bridges at Fredericksburg, 2 at the upper end of town, 1 below the railroad bridge at the lower end of Fredericksburg, and 3 south of town. If you look past the reconstructed pontoon bridge, through the gap in the trees, you will see the stretch of river where Union engineers laid the 2 upper bridges. Burnside hoped that by crossing at Fredericksburg, he would catch Lee off guard. He didn't. The Confederate general had more than 1,000 Mississippi soldiers guarding the town. Before the Union engineers could complete the bridges, the Mississippians opened fire, killing or wounded many of the engineers and driving the rest back here to the Stafford shore. Officers urged the engineers to return to their task, but they no sooner set foot on the bridges than Confederate soldiers shot them down. If Burnside wished to complete the bridges, he would first have to silence the Mississippi riflemen. But how? Walk up the steps behind you to the next terrace and stand beside the large cannon that you'll find there. Burnside's best chance for success at Fredericksburg was to cross the Rappahannock River and attack Lee quickly before the Confederate general could concentrate his army. But the stiff resistance of Lee's Mississippians threatened to upset that plan. In an effort to drive off the Confederates, Burnside ordered his artillery to bombard the town. For 9 hours, more than 150 cannon, some as big as this 4.5-inch ordnance rifle, shelled Fredericksburg, hurling thousands of shells into the doomed city. Some buildings caught fire. Others collapsed under the barrage, but the Mississippians stubbornly held their ground. In desperation, Burnside ordered his infantry to cross the river in pontoon boats and drive the Confederates out. At 3 p.m., the Union cannons fell silent. At the same instant, 135 soldiers from the 7th Michigan Infantry Regiment rushed toward the shoreline, shoved half a dozen pontoon boats into the water, and began frantically rowing for the opposite shore. Although the Mississippians fired on the Union soldiers as they crossed, surprisingly few were hurt. Once they reached the other side, the Michigan men clambered out of their boats and charged into town, engaging the Confederates in house-to-house fighting. It was the first instance of an amphibious assault and of urban fighting in American history. Other regiments followed the 7th Michigan across the river, and by sunset, the Union Army had completed its bridges and was in possession of the town. The next day, 30,000 Union soldiers marched past Chatham, filed down the ravine 200 yards to your right, and marched across the bridges. Thousands more crossed the pontoon bridges farther downstream to your left. Lee, meanwhile, took advantage of the time gained for him by his Mississippi riflemen to assemble his army on the heights south and west of the town. When Burnside attacked Lee's position on December 13th, he suffered a bloody, hands-down defeat. Fredericksburg's appearance has changed relatively little since the December 13th battle. The three steeples that overlooked the town in 1862 still dominate the skyline today. The small rounded cupola on the left is the courthouse. The large green steeple in the center is St. George's Episcopal Church. And the white steeple on the right belongs to Fredericksburg Baptist Church. Marie's Heights is the wooded ridge just behind the town, between the two church steeples. It's there that Burnside suffered his greatest losses. After the war, Congress set aside a portion of Fredericksburg Battlefield as a national military park. The docents inside Chatham will be happy to provide you with information on how to tour the battlefield. Walk back to the main house. To the left, as you approach the building, you'll see two gnarled catalpa trees. Stand next to the trees and turn your player back on. The Army of the Potomac retreated back across the Rappahannock River on the night of December 15th. With it, it brought nearly 10,000 wounded soldiers, casualties of the fighting 2 days earlier. The wounded men were taken to various field hospitals here in Stafford County. One of the largest field hospitals was here at Chatham. As early as December 11th, Union soldiers began converting the Lacey's hallways, bedrooms, and public rooms into makeshift operating rooms and patient wards. Over the next 2 weeks, hundreds of wounded men passed through its doors. Surgeon J. Franklin Dyer was in charge of the medical facility. He wrote his wife, "I have the house full. Men lie on the floors as close as they can be stowed. A little straw here and there, the best we can do for them. Back of the house I have 6 hospital tents, 10 in each tent, with no fire, and the weather is cold. We cover the ground with pine boughs and give them as many blankets as possible." Dyer used the room adjacent to the catalpa trees as his surgery. Most of the operations that he and other surgeons performed were amputations. Once doctors removed an arm or a leg, they disposed of it by simply tossing it out the window. Over time, the bloody limbs piled up in front of the house. Walt Whitman made a visit to Chatham 1 week after the battle. As he left, he encountered the ghastly pile of limbs lying at the foot of a tree within 10 yards of the house, enough limbs, he asserted, to fill a 1-horse cart. The tree that he saw is undoubtedly one of these two catalpas. The heroic efforts of Surgeon Dyer and other doctors saved hundreds of lives, but they couldn't save everyone. A few feet from here, Whitman saw the bodies of several deceased soldiers, with brown woolen blankets pulled over their heads, and a number of freshly dug graves, each with a soldier's name carved on a piece of broken board overhead. Most soldiers buried at Chatham were taken away after the war. At our next stop, however, we'll see one who wasn't. Return to the cannon that you saw earlier. As you face the river, look to your left, and you'll see a wall topped by white sculptures representing pineapples, the symbol of Southern hospitality. Just past the wall, on the right, is a large boxwood. At the foot of the shrub, lying flush to the ground, is the grave of an unknown Union soldier. See if you can find it. We don't know exactly how many soldiers were treated at Chatham, but we do know approximately how many died here. After the war, burial parties unearthed the remains of 133 Union soldiers that had been buried on the Lacy's property and reinterred them in Fredericksburg National Cemetery on Marie's Heights. Years later, the remains of three additional soldiers were found at Chatham, men who had been overlooked by the burial parties. By then, Fredericksburg National Cemetery was full and was closed to new burials. Rather than take the soldiers' remains to a national cemetery outside the area, Chatham's owner decided to leave the men where they were and mark their graves with simple headstones. This grave belongs to one of those soldiers. Return now to the main house. As you face the house, you'll notice that there are three doors. Stand next to the door on the right and turn your player back on. Following the Battle of Fredericksburg, the Army of the Potomac camped for the winter here in Stafford County. Most Union regiments pitched their tents at least a mile or two back from the Rappahannock River, where they were out of sight and artillery range of Lee's Confederates, who continued to occupy the town. During the winter, small bodies of Union soldiers occupied Chatham as a picket post. Pickets were sentries placed along the perimeter of an army to provide early warning of the enemy's approach. Here at Fredericksburg, the Rappahannock River divided the two armies, so the picket lines ran along the river. Soldiers generally stood guard for 4 hours at a time, sometimes in rain or snow, and often in sub-freezing temperatures. Occasionally, if the wind was right, they traded with one another by means of small, handmade sailboats. Union soldiers sent coffee, the Confederates sent tobacco. When not on duty, Union soldiers would return to their picket post, in this case Chatham, to sleep, eat, play cards, or simply relax until it was their turn to go back outside for another 4 hours of misery. This went on for several days until their picket duty ended. They then tramped back to camp, and another regiment took their place. During the winter months, the Union Army cut down trees for fuel, corduroy roads, and log cabins. Within a couple of months, they'd cut down nearly every tree in this part of the county, leaving just a few of the bigger ones around the houses for shade. As trees in this area grew scarce, soldiers sometimes had to walk for more than a mile to collect firewood. Rather than do that, they simply pried the paneling off Chatham's interior walls with their bayonets. Once the panels were gone, the men scribbled their names on the plaster below. Some soldiers carved their names directly into the wood itself. That was the case here. If you look at the right side of the door frame in front of you, you'll see a plain wood panel inscribed with the initials RW and the characters 108NYV. After the war, owners painted over this graffiti. It remained hidden until recent years when National Park Service employees stripped the paint from the panel and once again exposed the letters to view. We have identified the soldier as Richard Wells, an 18-year-old soldier in the 108th New York Volunteers. Wells fought at the Battle of Fredericksburg and later did picket duty here along the river. The bored teenager probably cut his initials into the house at that time. Follow the slate path that leads past the catalpas. It will lead you through a side gate and into the garden on the other side of the house. Stand in the middle of the garden and restart your player. The Civil War brought destruction to many parts of the South. That was certainly true here at Chatham, which over a period of 2 years alternately served as a Union headquarters, hospital, and picket post. When the Lacys returned to their home in 1865, they found it a shambles. Soldiers had smashed the windows, wrenched paneling from the walls, and tore doors and shutters from their hinges. Graffiti covered the walls, and blood stained the floors. Where there had once been beauty, they now saw only desolation. Soldiers had cut down their trees, trampled their gardens, and turned their lawn into a cemetery. There were no slaves to repair the damage. No money either. In 1872, the Lacys had to sell Chatham to pay their taxes. They left Fredericksburg and moved to Elwood, their country home in Spotsylvania County. For 50 years, Chatham languished. Part of that time was owned by carpetbaggers, northerners with money who came south after the war to snatch up places like Chatham at bargain prices. They lived at Chatham for a few years, sold off some of the land to pay taxes, and then moved on. In the 1890s, one owner actually painted the exterior of the house mustard yellow with maroon trim. If you look closely at the brickwork on the main house, you can still see traces of the yellow paint, even today. Daniel and Helen DeVore rescued Chatham from its sad fate. The couple purchased the house in the 1920s, and over a period of 10 years, restored the property to its former grandeur. Among the improvements that they made was the addition of this beautiful garden, which they filled with flowers, shrubs, and classical statues. As an added touch, the DeVores raised peacocks, which strutted freely throughout the grounds. As a result of their restoration, Chatham's value soared. The DeVores sold the property in 1931, at the height of the Great Depression, for $150,000, a modest sum now, but a king's ransom in those days. One of the few men in the country able to afford such an expensive estate was John Lee Pratt, the vice president of General Motors Corporation. During World War II, Mr. Pratt had served on the War Resources Board, where he became friends with General George Marshall. On one occasion, Marshall drove down to Fredericksburg to go duck hunting with Mr. Pratt. The general and his wife spent the night in Chatham's caretaker's residence before returning to Washington the next day. The caretaker's residence, by the way, is the small white house adjacent to the place where you parked your car. John Lee Pratt lived at Fredericksburg for 44 years. When he died here in 1975, he donated the house and 30 acres of land to the United States government for inclusion in Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. It's thanks to his generosity that we're able to show you the house today. I hope you've enjoyed your tour of Chatham. I think you'll agree it's one of America's great homes. Before we're leaving, remember to return your player to the docent in the main house.